So if you go down into the Amazon jungle right now and you just eat the leaves of the Cycotria viridis plant, absolutely nothing will happen to your brain. Like, it is entirely biologically inactive.
Right, yeah, nothing at all.
But, centuries ago, somebody figured out that if you take those exact specific leaves and you boil them with one highly specific vine out of, what, the roughly 80,000 plant species in the
Yeah,
Amazon?
tens of thousands, easily.
So out of all those, you mix this one vine in and you suddenly create this this chemical key that basically unlocks the universe.
It really is a statistical anomaly. I mean, it completely upends our whole modern Western expectation of what advanced pharmacology actually looks
Oh,
like.
for sure.
Because, we expect precision engineering to come from some sterile,
All right.
white-walled lab, right? Not an ancient jungle brew.
Exactly, which brings us right into today's deep dive. So, welcome to July 2026. You really can't open a browser, watch a documentary, or like even walk past a coffee shop right now without hearing about the psychedelic renaissance.
No, it's absolutely everywhere.
It really is. But separating the actual rigorous neuroscience from all the well from the wellness industry hype, it's starting to feel like a full-time job.
Yeah, the space is incredibly noisy right now.
Right?
You have a whole lot of romanticizing on one side, and then a lot of really aggressive clinical oversimplification on the other.
Which is exactly why our mission today is to cut through all of that noise. We're unpacking this fascinating piece from the OOTW Journal. It's titled "Ayahuasca versus Psilocybin: The Neuroscience."
It's a great paper.
It is, because if you ask people which of these two is the, the deeper medicine, you usually end up with like a fist fight dressed up as a conversation.
Oh, absolutely. People
For
get
sure.
very, very attached to their preferred compound.
You really do. But our goal here isn't to declare a winner. We just want to give you, the listener, a really clear, thorough understanding of how these two substances actually work in your brain, like their real-world physical risks and what the actual clinical realities are today.
Because I think once you understand how the pharmacology directly dictates the physical experience, you sort of you stop arguing about which one is better. And you start realizing that they are fundamentally different tools. Like they're designed for entirely different frameworks.
Okay, so before we can even talk about why a psilocybin journey feels so completely different from an ayahuasca ceremony, we have to establish the most surprising fact in this entire OOTW Journal article. After all the wildly divergent preparations, the different cultures, the varying hours spent under the influence, they both ultimately target the exact same molecular switch in the brain.
Yeah, they both converge on the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
Which is wild.
It is. That specific receptor is basically the master switch for the classic psychedelic experience. When it gets activated, it triggers this whole cascade of effects that alter how the brain processes information. And this is specifically explained through something called the REBS model.
Right, the Rebus model. I was looking at that in the journal, and it stands for relaxed beliefs under psychedelics.
Exactly.
And the phrase neural entropy just keeps coming up in there. Now, I know entropy means chaos in like physics, but I'm having a really hard time visualizing what chaos actually looks like functionally in the human brain. How does activating that 5-HT2A receptor actually create that?
Okay, so think of your everyday brain as this incredibly rigid prediction machine.
Okay.
It relies on very strict hierarchies, specifically the default mode network, or DMN, to filter out the overwhelming amount of sensory data you encounter every single second.
Like it's just blocking out the noise so you can function.
Exactly. It uses these deeply ingrained habits and assumptions to just navigate the world efficiently. But when you activate that 5-HT2A receptor, it temporarily flattens those habitual hierarchies. The filtering system basically drops offline.
Wow. So the chaos or, the entropy just means that regions of the brain that normally never speak to each other are suddenly communicating directly. Like without the ego acting as a sort of middleman to interpret all the signals.
That direct, unfiltered communication is the entropy. Yeah, the rigid, top-down control of your mind is just loosened.
That's fascinating.
Right. And that shared destination, that 5-HT2A activation, kind of, shaking the snow globe of your neural pathways, that is exactly why a high-dose mushroom session and an ayahuasca night share a really profound mechanistic similarity at their absolute core.
But, and this is the crazy part, the way they actually arrive at that receptor could not be more different.
Oh, entirely different.
Yeah, the article describes psilocybin as elegantly simple. It's what they call a prodrug.
Right.
Which means the psilocybin molecule itself is mostly biologically inactive when you first ingest it. But then your body acts like this little chemical scissor, right? Stripping off a phosphate group to convert it into psilocin.
Exactly.
And that psilocin is the actual key that turns the 5-HT2A lock. It's remarkably tidy, you know, one plant, one molecular conversion.
Yeah, it's very straightforward. But you contrast that with ayahuasca, which the OOTW piece correctly labels a pharmacological hack.
Got hacked.
Because the visionary punch of ayahuasca comes from DMT, and that's typically sourced from those Psychotria viridis leaves we mentioned at the start.
Right. But again, as we said, just eating those leaves does absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
And that is because of an enzyme in your gut and your liver called monoamine oxidase A, or MAOA. Its entire biological job is to just break down neurotransmitters.
Right. It's the cleanup crew.
Exactly. And it will destroy oral DMT almost instantly upon ingestion. The DMT never makes it to your bloodstream, much less your brain.
So to bypass that, the Amazonian brew relies on the addition of the Banisteriopsis caapivine.
That one specific vine out of the 80,000.
Right. And that vine contains beta-carbolines,
yeah.
Specifically harmaline, and tetrahydroharmaline, or THH.
Right.
Those compounds are potent MAO inhibitors. They literally just temporarily switch off that MAOA enzyme in your gut.
It's essentially a biological heist. Like, I was thinking about it this way. Psilocybin is like handing your brain a VIP pass that works immediately at the door. You just walk right into the club.
I like that, yeah.
But ayahuasca is like trying to sneak a VIP, the DMT pass, a remarkably strict bouncer, which is your gut's MAOA enzyme.
Yes.
And the only way the DMT gets inside the club is because the vine creates this massive, highly coordinated distraction that just ties up the bouncer in the alleyway, letting the DMT slip right by.
That's a great analogy. And because that bouncer is tied up in the alleyway, the entire security apparatus of your digestive tract is basically compromised for hours.
Wow.
This isn't just a clever delivery mechanism, you know?
Yeah.
It is the defining feature that entirely dictates the physical reality, the pacing, and crucially, the severe dangers of ayahuasca compared to psilocybin.
Yeah, and we see that immediately in the shape of the actual experience. I mean, both substances give you roughly a 4 to 6 hour acute window. But psilocybin has this very gentle, rolling come up, you know, 20 to 40 minutes. It sort of builds to a plateau, and then it eases down into what the journal calls a coherent arc.
Right.
Ayahuasca, though, does not ease you in at all. It hits violently, usually within 30 to 60 minutes, bringing profound nausea and the famous purge very early in the experience.
Yeah, and pharmacologically, that purge is a direct result of the DMT and those beta-carbolines heavily stimulating the gut and the brainstem.
It's a physical reaction.
Exactly. Your body is basically reacting to a massive influx of potent alkaloids combined with the sudden, highly unnatural shutdown of its primary digestive enzymes.
And because that bouncer is still tight up, this introduces medical risks that psilocybin simply does not have. With psilocybin, you know, the risks are mostly transient.
Yeah, temporary nausea, maybe a slight blood pressure spike.
Right, or the psychological hazard of a destabilizing trip. But ayahuasca's MAOI machinery alters how your entire body processes a whole class of everyday substances.
It does.
Mm.
Because MAOA breaks down way more than just DMT.
Yeah.
It's responsible for clearing out serotonin, norepinephrine, and a dietary amino acid called tyramine.
Tyramine, right.
So if you disable that enzyme with ayahuasca and you happen to be taking medications that raise serotonin like everyday SSRI or SNRI antidepressants, you risk something called serotonin syndrome.
Which is terrifying.
It really is. Your brain becomes completely flooded with more serotonin than it can clear. That can lead to high fever, seizures, and, I mean, it is a genuine life-threatening medical emergency.
And it's not even limited to pharmaceuticals either. Like, the journal mentions if you consume tyramine-rich foods like aged cheese or cured meats, while that MAOA enzyme is inhibited, you risk a dangerous massive spike in blood pressure.
Exactly. And psilocybin just simply lacks this MAOI machinery, meaning it completely avoids these specific, really severe interaction risks.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting, because the wellness industry tends to completely gloss over those severe pharmacological realities.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah. And I really want to push back on a specific claim, the OOTW piece flags, because there's a massive marketing push right now claiming that ayahuasca regrows your brain.
Right, the neurogenesis claims.
Yes. Now, the journal does note there is preclinical data showing that harmine and DMT promote neurogenesis via the sigma-1 receptor, but they are emphatic that this data comes from cell cultures and rodents.
Yeah, the mechanistic data there is undeniably fascinating. I mean, watching harmine stimulate neural progenitor cells in a lab setting is just exciting science.
Sure.
But equating that to actual human clinical outcomes is a massive, highly premature leap.
It's the difference between, like, proving a seed can sprout in a highly climate-controlled greenhouse and claiming that that same seed will grow into a redwood tree in the middle of a desert.
That's exactly it.
We have the greenhouse data for neurogenesis in mice. We absolutely do not have the desert data for humans in the jungle.
We completely lack the desert data.
Yeah.
And running with that assumption is frankly dangerous,
right,
especially when retreats use it to market to really vulnerable populations.
Yeah.
Regardless of any potential for neurogenesis, neither of these substances should ever be used without rigorous medical screening. Anyone with a personal or family history of psychosis, bipolar disorder, or significant cardiac issues really needs to understand that these compounds can be deeply, deeply destabilizing.
Right. And because that risk of serotonin syndrome is so severe and the actual physical toll of the MAOI hack is so intense, researchers face a massive ethical and logistical hurdle with ayahuasca.
Oh, it's a nightmare for researchers.
Yeah. Like, you cannot just administer it in a standard double-blind clinical setup. And that logistical nightmare is exactly why the clinical scoreboard between these two substances looks so wildly lopsided right now in 2026.
Yeah, psilocybin has amassed this really deep, highly rigorous clinical bench, precisely because its single molecule prodrug nature just fits so neatly into the Western clinical trial structure.
The numbers in the journal highlight just how far ahead it is. I mean, Compass Pathways is clearly leading the charge with their synthetic psilocybin, COMP360. Mm-hmm. They have two positive phase 3 trials specifically for treatment-resistant depression. We are looking at KeyCom-005, which reported out in 2025 with around 258 participants, I think.
That's right.
And CQMP-006, which just reported in February 2026, they are actively targeting an FDA submission later this year.
And we have to remember, treatment-resistant depression is incredibly difficult to manage because the patient's neural pathways have become just hyper-rigid.
Right.
So returning to the RBS model we talked about, psilocybin's ability to temporarily flatten those rigid hierarchies offers a completely different mechanism of action than, say, taking a daily SSRI, which often just kind of numbs the emotional baseline.
Right, right. Though we do need to point out a crucial nuance the journal highlights regarding the famous 2021 Carhart-Harris study.
Oh, I guess.
Because that was the trial comparing psilocybin directly to the standard SSRI escitalopram. And the mainstream headline screamed that psilocybin just outright beat the daily antidepressant.
They really did. But the actual primary outcome of that study showed they were comparable, not statistically superior.
Right, a really important distinction.
Very important. Psilocybin is remarkably effective for many, but the data just does not support it as this mathematical magic bullet that obliterates standard care across every single metric. Still, you know, its data is robust, it's heavily controlled, and it is moving steadily through the FDA pipeline.
And then we look at ayahuasca's clinical scoreboard. The journal highlights its flagship human trial. Pajano Fontes, in 2019, published in Psychological Medicine. It was a rigorous, randomized, placebo-controlled trial for treatment-resistant depression, but it only had 29 patients.
Right.
14 got ayahuasca, 15 got a placebo.
Yeah, and the vast majority of the remaining data on ayahuasca is purely observational. It's drawn from naturalistic settings or long-term ceremonial users.
It's like comparing a heavily scouted professional athlete psilocybin, where you have years of verified stats, biomechanical analysis, and just thousands of hours of tape, to a local streetball legend, ayahuasca.
Yes.
Everyone swears the streetball legend is the greatest they've ever seen, but all you have is some shaky smartphone footage and eyewitness accounts to actually prove it.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you can't simply send scientists into the jungle to get better tape on the streetball legend.
Because of the trial structures.
Right. An FDA-style trial demands rigorous blinding and placebo controls. But how do you blind a trial where the active group violently purges for an hour and the placebo group just doesn't?
You can't. You'd know immediately which one you got.
Exactly. And how do you isolate the chemical effect of the DMT from the profound cultural framing, you know? The expectation, the music, the group dynamic of a ceremony. You just can't. Anyone calling ayahuasca a proven depression treatment in the Western medical sense is completely ignoring the reality of the evidence.
And that inability to standardize ayahuasca directly translates to why these two substances are treated so completely differently by the law and by society right now in 2026.
Oh, definitely.
Federally, the United States still classifies both as Schedule I substances. Psilocybin is scheduled on its own, and ayahuasca is illegal because of its DMT content.
But the state level and cultural reality is completely fractured at this point.
Yeah.
Psilocybin is being rapidly medicalized because, well, it scales beautifully within Western capitalism.
Yeah.
It is a single molecule with a predictable, coherent arc.
You see that in the state-regulated adult access programs in Oregon and Colorado and in New Mexico, which just legalized it by legislation in 2025.
Yeah,
you literally go to a licensed service center. You sit with a trained facilitator in a controlled, sterile room, usually with like eye shades and a curated instrumental playlist.
Yeah, whereas ayahuasca fundamentally resists that clinical capital scaling. It remains legally restricted to very narrow, specific religious exemptions.
Like the 2006 Supreme Court ruling, right?
Right, which allowed churches like the UDV and Santa Dame to use it sacramentally. But outside of those specific religious carve-outs or personal decriminalization laws like Colorado's, serving ayahuasca remains a federal offense. It basically demands a syncretic or indigenous framework.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? If you started listening to this deep dive wondering which one is stronger or which one is better, the journal makes it incredibly clear that you are just asking the wrong questions.
Completely the wrong questions. The question is entirely about fit. What is the appropriate container for the individual? Psilocybin is this evidence-forward, single-molecule track moving toward regulated, standardized medicine, offering a comparatively clean interaction profile.
And ayahuasca is a pharmacologically ingenious sacrament. The exact chemistry that gives it its magic, that MAOI hack, allowing the DMT to actually survive digestion, is simultaneously its greatest hazard.
Right. It demands a completely different level of physical screening, dietary restriction, and psychological preparation.
Yeah.
They absolutely share a destination at that 5-HT2A receptor, but the journey to get there and the specific physiological tolls extracted along the way are entirely distinct.
So to bring all of this together, both of these profound substances unlock the exact same 5-HT2A receptor in the brain, flattening those rigid habitual hierarchies we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else, you know, psilocybin's neat prodrug conversion versus ayahuasca's statistically improbable botanical hack, the drastically different safety profiles regarding SSRIs and tyramine, the lopsided clinical trials, and the completely divergent legal paths makes them two entirely different worlds.
Yeah, and if there is one fundamental mechanism you take away from this, it is understanding the MAOI dimension of ayahuasca.
Absolutely. You do not need to memorize tetrahydroharmine or the exact phosphate conversion of psilocin.
Yeah.
But understanding that MAOI hack, knowing that ayahuasca requires shutting down a key enzyme in the gut, which in turn makes it incredibly dangerous to mix with certain medications or foods, that is your shortcut to being the most well-informed person in the room.
It really is.
It just cuts right through the wellness hype and gets straight to the biology.
Because it is the biological reality that ultimately dictates the ritual.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something that builds on everything we've unpacked today. We've established that the raw chemistry in the brain is remarkably similar, right? They both flip that same 5-HT2A switch to create neural entropy.
Right.
But if that exact same receptor activation can feel like a fluid emotional arc when you're lying on a couch in a sterile, regulated clinic with eye shades on, yet it manifests as a visceral spirit encounter complete with purging when you're sitting in a dark jungle ceremony. What does that actually say about us?
Hmm.
Like, how much of our everyday reality, our deepest, most profound emotional experiences are simply a product of our environment and our cultural expectations rather than just the raw chemistry firing in our brains?
It strongly suggests that the setting isn't just the background of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
It might actually be the lens through which the chemistry becomes our reality.
Yeah. From the precision engineering of a modern clinical trial to a master class in pharmacology brewed centuries ago in the Amazon, it really makes you rethink what advanced medicine looks like. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.